boxes of letters. You cannot believe how many boxes of letters we got every week from people in the remote rural areas when the post offices still worked, would post a letter to us, often asking us. We were the first point of information for HIV/AIDS. The government was in denial, as many countries are in denial at the start of the epidemic. So I'm not blaming them for that, but we were the first point. We used to hide our sensitive letters. We used to send them to our lawyers for safekeeping, because I'd had previous experience in South Africa, and I said, you know, if they're serious about us, they'll come for our letters and they'll go for the people who wrote to us. And sure enough, they did. But we had them safe. So that was the beginning of a struggle for the press in Zimbabwe. After the state had now closed, the Zimbabwe newspapers was now a government mouthpiece, the electronic media was now a government mouthpiece, the Act of Parliament was ignored, the trust that had been set up to secure a first free press after Rhodesia, because there was no free press in Rhodesia, it had gone. Parade was on its own. Out of Parade, however, and I then left the country and went to South Africa in the beginning of 1991 after the ANC had been unbanned, and my South African husband, who was a journalist, could then return home. And so as he had come with me to Zimbabwe, I went with him to South Africa for the four bloody years leading up to democratic elections in 1994. In my absence in that period, Andrew Moyes, the editor of Parade, it collapsed, and he went on to form a magazine called Horizon. A daily newspaper had formed, it went broke. There's been this constant efforts by Zimbabweans to establish a regular supply of unbiased, well-resourced information. And if there is a hero of the Zimbabwe media, his name is Andrew Moyes. And he's still in Harare today running the Media Monitoring Project. There are some guys from VOA Studio 7 who are coming in here, both of them trained by him at the beginning of their careers. He set a benchmark for all journalists to do it as it should be done. And he's now running the Media Monitoring Project because there isn't anywhere for him to go. Then there was the Daily News came just before the new opposition party emerged in September 1999. Just before that, money was raised, and the Daily News, a crisp daily tabloid newspaper, such a relief from this turgid, boring rubbish in the Herald newspaper. There was this fresh, lovely little jewel, and it went on. I think its mistake was that it became an opposition newspaper, and therefore it didn't have distance to do what journalists have to do, but nevertheless it was just fantastic to have it. And they bombed it. They bombed its press. They bombed the entrance to the Daily News. They bombed that. They bombed the press and just destroyed it. They bombed the journalists. They arrested the journalists. They stuck them in prison. They beat them. They broke their cameras. You name it, they did it. And it was a long process, and it is no more. We are now left with The Independent, which publishes on a Friday, and I read it this morning. And there it is. Very good little newspaper. It's a tabloid, and it's incredibly expensive for ordinary Zimbabweans. It sells probably 35,000 copies a week. And it's urban-based. There is no media in the rural areas where 70% of the population live. If they've got batteries for their radio, which most of them haven't these days, or a solar panel, which one or two have, they can listen to the turgid rubbish coming out of Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation on four channels. They do not know what is going on in their country 20 miles away, let alone what is going on in Parliament or in the struggle for democracy or whatever one wants to call it. They do not know what is going on, because the oral tradition of people in the urban areas going to their kamusha, their home areas, to see their relatives has almost stopped because people can't afford to do it. They can't afford the bus rides. There's just no information going out there. I was there 3 weeks ago. in an area that Norma Krieger knows very well. We discussed it the other night, where I went up almost to the Mozambique border in Mashonaland East and across. I think I did 700 kilometers. I have to remember how to say it for VOA, kilometers, across down to Ushinga. I saw the green bombers, Mugabe's private army in new uniforms, cheering us along. I had a wonderful cover. I had a wonderful cover, so I was never going to be caught. And I spoke to people who did not know I was a journalist, and I tried to find out what they knew, and they hardly knew anything. They knew their own lives, that they had nothing in their little trading stores. There was no seed for the planting season, which is now. They had no seed. They had no fertilizer. They didn't know why they didn't have it. They didn't know what the value of the money was. They couldn't understand why there was nothing in the shops. Their small world, and this is Mugabe's heartland where I was. Their children are going to school. It's an orderly, polite, incredibly polite, orderly society where, I mean, there are villages there that I shouldn't think a white person has been there other than the missionary for many decades. And I can assure you, I was in no danger. I enjoyed their company. I thought they were charming and hospitable. When they were offering me a cup of tea and stuff, of course you don't accept anything from Zimbabweans anymore as a cup of tea, because you know that it's their last cup of tea. So I had my own water with me. I felt incredibly serene and safe there and enjoyed their company and was terribly sorry that they have no idea what has engulfed their lives. And so that newspaper, The Independent, never reaches them. It's too expensive. Could never get out there. They can't get the radio. If they do get the radio, they just hear what the ruling ZANU-PF is doing, and it gives them good news. I read the paper this morning, the Herald newspaper this morning, very good news. Zimbabwe's on the road to recovery. They say that every day. It's on the road to recovery. They never mention that it's got 8,000% inflation, the highest in the world, nor that the Zimbabwe dollar, and I've got one here. I hope I've got one here. This is the latest highest denomination currency. This is $200,000. They chopped three noughts off in August 2006, so it's really $200 million. It doesn't buy a loaf of bread. I mean, it doesn't buy a loaf of bread also because there isn't any bread. But if it did, if there was bread, it wouldn't buy a loaf of bread. It's worth 20 American cents at best. And this is a country that at independence, the Zimbabwe dollar was worth the equivalent of a US dollar. So the unofficial rate, which is the only rate, the black market is the only money market for the United States dollar, is 1 million. It'll be 1,100,000 probably tomorrow morning. It'll be going up 100,000 a day. It is a chaotic situation. And the tragedy of all of this is that the Zimbabweans, who are 70% of the population, do not know why it is happening, excepting they are told by ZANU-PF that it's caused by America, it's caused by George Bush and Tony Blair. They haven't quite got onto Gordon Brown's name yet. That's what's caused it, and that it's sanctions. The only sanctions there are travel sanctions and the Zimbabwe Democracy Act in America, which means that the American government has a casting vote in the IMF so that Zimbabwe cannot get balance of payment support, but nobody would ever lend Zimbabwe money, even if there wasn't the Zimbabwe Democracy Act, because they can't pay it back. But those are the only sanctions. But that is what the people in the rural areas heard, and that is also what I heard when I was out there 3 weeks ago, that it's George Bush. They know George Bush's name better than they know a lot of other names. George Bush's name, Tony Blair's name, and sanctions. Other than that, there's economic recovery around the corner. And I'm afraid the people of Zimbabwe have no idea what has engulfed the best educated population, not only in Africa, maybe in the third world, a country which had, and Mugabe did brilliantly, with education and healthcare. He did do it. They have no idea why. Their lives are turned into just unbearable misery. And yet they're cheerful and out there. I miss them. As I'm talking now, I've got an inner eye that I'm seeing on the road to Nyamapanda of a really engaging conversation I had with the woman on the road there and her son, and the jokes we told each other. So if there are any questions, that's all I can really tell you about Zimbabwe. Yeah.
I'm curious, you were talking about in the rural areas that people had no idea, they don't get the newspapers, in VOA, and is that because of the lack of radio or the shortwave being jammed?
The medium wave out of Gaborone is jammed. VOA, for those who don't know, has something called Studio 7, which broadcasts using Zimbabwe journalists into Zimbabwe. It should be an incredibly useful service. It's jammed. The Chinese are jamming it on the medium wave. They are picking up if they've got shortwave radios. Who in this room has last used a shortwave radio? I'm a real radio fiend, and I hate shortwave radios. It's so hard to tune. So they're hardly picking it up. I know that they hope that they're picking up. They'd have to have batteries for those radios, or solar power, or they'd have to have a wind-up radio. My son took in a whole lot of wind-up radios to people, but I mean, we're talking a few hundreds. Are they getting the news? Shortwave Radio Africa in London does some absolutely fantastic work. They have exactly the same problem. Zimbabweans, one of whom now is at Stanford, they try to do it as well. However, there's an enormous exile population in Johannesburg, and they do every night. Don't phone a Zimbabwean between 6 and 7 o'clock at night in Johannesburg, because they're all listening. They're listening to stories about home, because it's the only way they can get. And there are, I do not know how many there are in South Africa, and I won't even put an estimate on it, but it is an enormous population there. So it does do, and that news eventually does filter home. But can you imagine if you couldn't tune into your radio, if you couldn't tune into your television, if you couldn't get a newspaper, would you know anything that's happening in your country? You just wouldn't, because you're also immobile, because you can't travel. So it's a really, that is the situation as it is. Yes, they try very hard to get the information, but the Chinese are jamming it.
Do you want me to take maybe a couple of questions?
Yeah, whatever questions anyone wants to ask. Is anyone with any questions?
Maybe we'll take two at a time. And
thank you very much. I guess I'm curious about how hard you find it over time getting a story into the Telegram through the South Africa. And I presume it's harder and harder because the Middle East is consuming a large amount of portion of the newspapers these days. And unless the Telegraph was actually kept, and the Guardian would never write a story of the particularly anti Guardian.
Oh no, you're completely wrong.
So why have the British media, besides the Telegraph, especially the BBC, the Guardian, just give it up on Zimbabwe? Is it obsessive political correctness, or is it more simple?
It's copy tasting. Just straight copy-tasting. Nobody is being shot dead in Zimbabwe. There are no bombs. It's a quiet and silent war. They're actually, the Guardian only isn't covering it as much as it did at the moment, because Andrew Meldrum was the journalist at the Guardian, was actually heaved physically out of the country a few years ago, and they send people in as tourists to cover it, and it's extremely expensive to do that and extremely dangerous to do that. They all try and cover it. It's a former British colony. I have absolutely no... I have got stories backed up at the Telegraph from the trip I'm telling you that I went on that I really think need to be told, because I was in Mugabe's area, and because almost no journalists do those kind of stories, because you can operate somehow in Harare. But once you get out of town, there's a network like the Stasi out there. They say, oh, there's a new white woman there, and what's her car registration number? And they'll sell that information. And when people have got no jobs, it's good information. It does better. The Zimbabwe story does better than many, many, many other stories do, where more people are dying or more people are starving. Although I have to tell you, Zimbabwe has the lowest life expectancy in the world for women, age 34. So when that happens, I as a journalist cannot fault the copy tasting that goes on with the papers. And somebody like an organization like VOA, which broadcasts the service I work on, broadcasts into Africa, I can't give them enough. They take it from me every day. If I could find a new story to tell, because it's a repetitive story. I'm an old journalist. I've been doing this all my life. I know about finding angles, etc. It's an extremely repetitive story. I mean, the women of Zimbabwe arise, we'll get 85 women arrested, 160 on the streets, 85 arrested protesting water. Well, that's 10 more arrested than 6 weeks ago when they protested something else. It doesn't ever gain momentum. The protests don't gain momentum. If anything, they get less. And so it's quite a boring story for a lot of readers. I find it even difficult to read Zimbabwe stories. There's a flood of stuff. If you go to www.zimbabwesituation.com, there are two women in Australia who were educated in Zimbabwe who haven't slept for 7 years and who do it free of charge. They go into every website in the world and pull information, stories out about Zimbabwe from all over the world. And I'm amazed at the amount of it. I can't criticize that, nor can I criticize the way that the foreign press has looked after us. They have really tried to make our lives easier than they are. They know what it's like. We are well supported by lawyers if we get into trouble. It's the small fry out there, the little guys out there who don't work for big corporations and who suddenly get nailed. And we try to support them because there are journalists there whose names you will never see. I know who they are. We see each other on the street. And one day I'll be standing here and I'll introduce them to you, a couple of them, two or three. I can't really fault it. When the people are not being shot. There are no bombing raids. This is not Darfur. This is not even Chad or... No, it doesn't even rate as that sort of story. It's one man's determination to dismantle his country and impoverish his people, and I think send them all off to South Africa. I think he's very happy when they go to South Africa. They're Thabo Mbeki's problem then, not his. So thank you for your question. Thank you.
Yes.
You mentioned Chinese radio jamming. Could you talk a little bit more about who is interfering with the media and who is supporting it?
The Chinese are interfering with the media. Chinese all over Africa, aren't they? And mostly into cobalt at the moment, because I travel to Democratic Republic of Congo. The Chinese are interfering with our media. Where can I have a poster? And their own media, because I've met their journalists and I see what they put out, although I think one of them's defected, is lousy. Who's supporting the media? The West supports the media. I mean, they're journalists from the Daily News in Stanford. Thank you. Violet Gonda from SW Radio is at Stanford. I spoke to her an hour ago. And she's being trained there, and she's working out now how she can get $115 to pay her phone calls to try and continue covering for SW Radio on a wonderful program that she does called Hot Seat, where she gets Zimbabweans in long interviews, and even if they can't listen to it, it gets onto the internet, somebody photocopies it, gets out. At least people in the urban areas do know what she's doing. And she's at Stanford. Ray Chotto, who was so brutally tortured by the military in 2000. Brutally. I thought Ray was going to die. He's been to Stanford. So yes, the West is doing its traditional thing for the media. The South Africans are not helping the media. They've been really awful, and nor is Africa helping the media. The West is Britain, United States, the Scanders, the Scandinavians, or the Scandahooligans, as we used to call them. They're helping all the traditional people, and they're generous. You know, they're generous about it. And their scholarship programs. The problem is the journalists have gone. They've either been forced out, they're now on other passports, they can't get back, and we haven't got any. We haven't got any almost any journalists left in Zimbabwe. There's not a single photographer operating at the moment. The last photographer got nearly beaten to death on March the 11th. I saw him. I didn't think he was going to live. I can't take out a camera anywhere in Zimbabwe without getting arrested. So I've got one, you know, I'm such a useless photographer. I've got a little digital one, and I try and be tricky with it, but I always fail. You know, so that's how it is.
Did you have a question?
Well, she kind of answered. I was going to ask a question on behalf of Menelisi Zimbabwe of the South African Broadcasting Corporation. You're South African.
I'm not. I'm Zimbabwean.
You're Zimbabwean, but you've obviously lived in both.
I can do both stories in both countries.
Yeah. Yeah, and Thabo Mbeki has emphasized why diplomacy. as a journalist, but also someone from the region, you know, as you just said, have you gotten the support, what you'd expect the neighbors to support
more? But Thabo Mbeki, I think, in 2000, before I was there, my predecessor was deported because he was British. It was seen as a white farmer story. And I have to say, why shouldn't the Daily Telegraph or the Guardian or the Manchester something or other run stories about people who look like them with the same surnames as them? It's news for them. There were other stories going on, but certainly the British press, we were at that story like rats up drains, because we're mostly freelancers and we made a great deal of money out of it. And anyway, presumably forced removals are cruel and inhuman, regardless of what colour people are affected by them. That there were other stories involved in that. There were other angles of the farm workers, etc., which we got to later. It took us about 8 months before I really got into the farm workers' stories, which is still quite an unknown and unwritten story. Yes, Thabo Mbeki and Africa saw this as a white farmer's story. It took a long time. It took a long time that even once the white farmer's issue was virtually over, the story continued, because there was a new group to terrorize. There was a new group to go for. And so it persisted, the story persisted, and now you have a situation where the Southern African Development Community, only after it was shocked when it saw pictures of Morgan Tsvangirai and about 30 others, on March the 11th, he's leader of the Movement for Democratic Change, one faction, he's the founding president of the MDC. When you saw these appalling pictures of them tortured on March the 11th, by March the 29th, the Southern African Development Community could avoid it no longer, held a special summit on Zimbabwe and tasked Thabo Mbeki to mediate between the ruling ZANU-PF and the MDC. What Thabo Mbeki wants is undisputed elections to emerge from this. And these negotiations are ongoing as we sit here today. They are ongoing every day. They're happening in Harare. When they get stuck, then they go to Pretoria and the South Africans try and unstick them. Where that is going, I have no idea. But it's taken 7 years. And they never acknowledged it, the other ills either. They saw it in the old anti-colonial way. They interpreted it that way. And let's face it, the opposition didn't do themselves much good at the beginning when they were formed in September 1999. I mean, you could see them in the rich, largely white suburbs in Johannesburg holding meetings, but they weren't in Kenya or Libya or Dar es Salaam out there telling Africans their stories. They were going south to whites down there. So they made some hindsight being the perfect science that it is, they made some dreadful mistakes and didn't do themselves any good either by that. Yeah.
How do you see Zimbabwe in terms of the media that goes to reconciliation?
Appalling. It'll have to be one of there's bottom lines on the mediation that's going on. One is the Access to Information and Protection of Privacy Act, which is what I endure, because I cannot get accreditation. I pay my money in January. I get a receipt, which I laminate to use as mitigation of sentence should I get arrested, because I cannot get accreditation. They will not give me accreditation. That has to go before there can be elections. What will they do about the State Broadcasting Corporation that, going back for 40 years, has been biased and partisan? What will they do about the Zimbabwe newspapers? How will they do that? There is no time nor the money to get an independent newspaper like the Daily News up and running again. There is no time. I don't know how. They're going to have to. And if they don't do that, you know, I think it's easier now for journalists to go in there than it has been for 5 or 6 years, because there are these negotiations going on and they don't want to arrest people like me. Well, maybe me. They might not care about me, but say if the New York Times sent somebody in right now, I think they wouldn't want to arrest them right at this moment while their negotiation's going on. So it's going to get easier, and it is getting easier for journalists to go in there. I don't think it's yet easier for photographers. I was looking for a photographer 3 weeks ago. I just couldn't find one. If the elections are going to be undisputed, they have to have free media. I don't know how they're going to do that, but it's on the negotiating table. Yeah.
I'm one of those old-fashioned people who still listens to shortwave radio. I've heard you reports many times.
Okay.
That's why I'm here today. I always assumed you were British. Now I've learned something.
Yeah.
But and because of that, I just wondered about what's your credibility among Africans. That said, you mentioned earlier in this presentation that Mugabe was the one who really founded a good medical, a healthcare system, and an education system. What happened, and when did it happen? What did he go wrong? Is he insane? Is he even the evil head of state doesn't wish to destroy his country? So something seems to have gone amiss.
About my credibility, I try not to be deeply offended and hurt when the Herald newspaper about once every 3 or 4 weeks in a column called Nathaniel Maneru, and I think he's a paedophile, hacks me off when he calls me a racist. I pretend I don't care. I do care very much. He's a racist. I know who he is. I know that's his pen name. I know who George Chirumba is, and I'll have a go at him one day, face to face. I'm not, you know, I really want to have a go at him. No, I think those of us who have endured this far, I think we've kind of won some space. I think we've won some space not only in Zimbabwe, and we've certainly won some space on the streets of Harare. We've won some space there, but I think even in South Africa. And it's only South Africa that remains with a racial obsession, because there are no whites in the rest of Africa. There are actually hardly any whites left in Zimbabwe, maybe 10, 15,000 of them, and they're mostly in old age homes. So it's no, the race thing is no longer such an issue, excepting in South Africa. Where did the healthcare and the education go wrong? It went wrong because the economy collapsed. I mean, the Americans provide all the money for antiretrovirals, the Americans in the West. They even pay for some of the doctors in the healthcare system. They supplement their salaries. There is no money. I mean, the hospitals have nothing. The doctors are always on strike because they only earn $3 a month. And these were well-trained doctors. They're no longer well-trained. I wouldn't have a Zimbabwean-trained doctor in the last 5 years clip my fingernail right now, because they haven't even got anatomy lecturers. And the whole sections of the medical school closed. It's just collapsed. It's gone. The children are emerging from school barely literate. And I tell you, if there was any, I'd like to know if there was a more literate nation in the third world than Zimbabwe. It's hard to imagine. It's gone. It's money. I mean, he's done this. He dismantled it. He dismantled it because he collapsed the economy. He did it step by step. I mean, in July, because the outgoing U.S. ambassador Christopher Dell, in his outgoing speech, and he was good for quotes every time he opened his mouth, Christopher Dell, always made a few bucks out of him. He said this economy will be collapsed by the end of the year, and the military who run Mugabe said, "God, this is regime change coming again." So they slashed the prices to the June 18th level. With 8,000% inflation. So there was looting of all the electrical goods and everything. People even got cars dirt cheap, and they got masses of bottles of cooking oil. Well, by the 2nd of July, there was nothing left in the shops. No cooking oil. There is no cooking oil, no meat, no cornmeal, mealy meal, which is the staple food. No sugar, no flour, no eggs, no dairy products. There was nothing left. There is only some vegetables, Harpic, which is a lavatory cleaner, and jelly powder. I saw it with my own eyes 3 weeks ago, because the prices were then pegged to 50% of production costs. Is he mad? Can't use the calculator. Never been able to use one. He's obsessed with staying in power. Why is he obsessed with staying in power at the age of 83? Gosh, it's a nice job. You know, I... It's a really nice job. He's got wonderful living standards. His family are well provided for. He has no idea of the misery of people. He just thinks it's people like me who are working for the CIA or MI6 or whatever, whoever I'm working for. Unfortunately, they didn't give me a pension. So he is unbalanced. He is incredibly unbalanced. He has a coarseness about him that few people outside ever see. When he comes to the UN, you see it. There's a coarseness in his language now that shocks a lot of Zimbabweans. He's not a particularly clever man, although he's got lots of degrees. He's not clever. He's cunning. And he's set up a system of patronage that other presidents should see how he does it. I mean, why don't people within ZANU-PF stand up to him? If they stand up to him, they will lose. What will they lose? They will lose material wealth. They will lose comfort zones, vehicles, land, air tickets, private education for their children in the United States. There are hundreds of Mugabe's colleagues' children studying in the United States. And that's all paid for by foreign currency, which the country doesn't have, but they've always got it. It's a nice life. And he's been like this since long before independence. We're starting to find out through a book, one book that's just been published in Zimbabwe, called Through the Darkness by Judith Todd, whose father was the one liberal white prime minister who the whites got rid of. She's written a book. It's the most important book to come out of Zimbabwe. You can only get it through Amazon.com. And it tells a post-independent story, but it's woven into the past. And Judith was herself a liberation fighter. And you read that and you realize he was at it even during the war, even during the Rhodesian War. When he was fighting the Rhodesians, he was also fighting his co-fighters. They'd been at it for a long time. It's not going to change. It's not going to get better for a long time. It is a country that has been dismantled.
I'm sorry I came in late. You may already have discussed this, but what do you think that Thabo Mbeki could have done, and why hasn't he done it? And what about those others, people of goodwill, who realize that this is devastating? I realize there's a great fear of immigration from Zimbabwe to South Africa, which could have all kinds of consequences. But what kind of coalition could there be, and why didn't it happen?
Let me step into Mbeki's spokesman's shoes. They say, what good would... They're never going to invade. Okay, we're not talking about war here. Let's get that out. What good would it have done to have shouted at Mugabe? Would it have achieved anything? It would have meant, and Becky's spokesman would say, that at the end of the day, now when the country is in such a crisis, that South Africa is the one place with the legitimacy that didn't slag him off to try and pick up the pieces. So they're in a good position to be doing what they're doing. What they did do so badly was in the 2002 presidential elections, when they sent their observers into Zimbabwe who declared the elections legitimate and credible, when they were appalling. That was connivance. That was connivance. They will not criticize Mugabe. He's 83 years old. He's a liberation fighter. Africa's still dealing with the, allegedly, with the after effects of colonialism. We know about the, unfortunately, the West didn't speak out about what happened in Matabeleland in the south of the country in the 1980s. They hardly said a word. The first time they really got crossed was over the white farms. They wasn't being crossed over the white farms, but Mugabe was able to use that in Africa, saying, well, they stayed silent when they were killing people in Matabeleland because they were black people. The moment they take a farm, the West goes mad. I mean, it wasn't like that, but Mugabe's able to use that argument. Whatever is happening, the only hope and chance there is that these negotiations that are going on will deliver better elections than in the past. Unfortunately, the opposition is in a paltry state, not only because it has been beaten into submission, its structures have been beaten, its people have been beaten, it's refused permission to have political meetings, It cannot operate like any political party. It cannot operate. They've also done it to themselves. You know, they're a divided political party. They haven't been terrific over money, some of them. They haven't been, they're fighting with each other at the moment in courts. They're divided. They've broken their constitution, their own party constitution, and Mugabe would probably win a free and fair election without having to beat anyone up if the elections are held in March without substantial reforms. I have written that, which some of the people in the opposition in Harare are extremely angry with me for writing that, but it happens to be the truth. So it's just for me, I'm so sorrowful about what's happened to Zimbabweans. When I look at them, and it's happened to me too. I mean, I feel wounded by what I see.
Okay, why were you being elected? What is destroyed?
They don't know anything else. What else do they know? He's the only name they know. They're dependent on him. The vast majority of people live in the rural areas. They're dependent on him and ZANU-PF for their children's survival, for the schools, for the pretend clinics, for the roads, for a favour, for a bit of cheap fertilizer, for a lift to town, for anything they want. They're completely dependent on him and ZANU-PF. The only danger to Mugabe is from his own party, from elements within his own party, and I read this morning that that moment has passed too. He's going to get 100% support from his party on December the 12th to be the ZANU-PF candidate for the next elections due in March, to give himself another 5 years in power. He will be 89 when he leaves. And he's in very good health.
Martha, and I'm from Zimbabwe.
Hello, Martha.
Hi. Thank you for the overview of the Zimbabwe situation. My question is whether you also think that the media is playing a role in escalating the conflict and also in concentrating on Mugabe as a problem. Does the media also think of the post-Mugabe era? What are the strategies
for life? None. Is the media escalating it? Who gets the media in Zimbabwe? How can you escalate it if people don't get any media? All they get is the Herald and the Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation. So yes, they escalate it. The state escalates hatred. It practices hate speech almost every day. It is extraordinary if you read the verbatim reports. They do escalate it, but you know, Zimbabweans, because of the colonial period, when they ignored Ian Smith's media, they've learned, the urban Zimbabweans have learned to read through the media. And it's only urban Zimbabweans who have any media. Yes, they do escalate it. Does the opposition press say, well, there isn't any really, any left now? It's such a small, tiny elite that can afford the Independent and the Standard, and I'm afraid the Financial Gazette is... says it's independent, but I think it's run by the state through other means. I don't think people have any media, and the urban people have learned to see through it. Strategies beyond Mugabe, no. I've read some of these risk analysis reports written by people who, no, I don't think there is. Let's hope that people like some Zimbabweans with deep pockets, I can think of a couple of the industrialists now in South Africa who have put their hands in their pockets, who did finance the Daily News and lost an enormous amount of money. I hope their pockets are still deep, because let's not make the mistake. Let's not make the same mistakes. Let's not have opposition newspapers. Let's have newspapers that are free of all political, because we need a period like that where we have no allegiances to any party, that we'll just tell it as it is. And a public broadcaster that will tell it as it is. It has no cameras left. I mean, even the presidential camera is broken now. I mean, you sit there and you watch this turgid tripe at 8 o'clock, this ghastly hour of broadcasting, which, as a foreign correspondent, I have to endure from time to time. That's about 2 or 3 times a week. And I'm always making excuses of why I can't watch it tonight. It's the worst in the world. It's the worst in the world. And there's so much talent out there. No, there are no strategies. I read about these strategies, but practically on the ground, no. Look, Violet Gonda's at Stanford being trained. Ray Chotto is being trained. Jeff Nerota is somewhere in America. There are plenty of journalists out there who've been trained. Maybe they'll all come home. Maybe they'll give up living in the UK and Hampshire and producing their papers in Britain and come home and produce them at home. We can hope for that.
I wondered if some of the journalists, independent journalists outside the country that are knowledgeable, couldn't have done some expose about Mugabe's fortunes, Grace Mugabe's expenditures.
I did it.
Where?
I did in the Daily Telegraph in August 2003. I, in a very complicated, I got pictures of his, what I call his palace, because it's 4.2 acres of accommodation over three floors. I think that's a palace. And I hired a law student to go through the government gazettes to see what he'd been paid every year, including his allowances, to see if he could have afforded to build that out of his legitimate funds. And he couldn't. So that was the first story we could say that Mugabe had got access to illegal funds. We do them all the time. They do. I'm always referring to when Grace Mugabe nicked a farm with 29 bedrooms and then didn't do anything with it. Oh, I wrote them. We all wrote those stories all the time. I mean, his house, we had pictures on the front page of the Daily Telegraph, in the Sunday Times in Johannesburg, in the Sunday Independent in Joburg. I remember driving through Joburg and seeing posters. I'd sold both stories. I was feeling so flush that weekend to both newspapers. The Sunday Times saying Mugabe's palace revealed, and the other one said Mugabe's mansion exclusive. And we did it. I mean, it may not have come to America, but certainly it's out there. No, we can't. They're in Malaysia. Anyone got any Malaysian banking contacts? I'm looking. I'm looking. Anyone with that? We know where they are. Well, can you help us? Please help us. And the Reserve Bank governor, we want to know about his money. We don't want to know about all of their money. But it does, we do. It's coming, it comes. There's stuff that comes all the time. These are not, I don't believe that these are the Mobutu Sese Sekos or the Philippines with the shoe fetishes. I don't think they're in that league. I think they were quite modest for a couple of decades. It's only in the last sort of 10 years that this gross accumulation has been going on. And I'm still not sure how gross it is, other than in Mugabe's point of view. And you know, he's just had a sack full of money from Equatorial Guinea's President Nguema, because President Nguema has oil, and Nguema runs one of the worst countries in the world. But Condoleezza Rice has decorated him because he's got oil. Yes, thank you.
My name is Brian Murphy. Picking up on your very final comment, you mentioned the quotable quotes by the previous American ambassador. Could you address the current efficacy of U.S. ambassador and how, if at all, the previous ambassador affected positively or negatively circumstances in Zimbabwe?
Christopher Dell had a real eye for an intro on a story. If he opened his mouth, we all filed, because he did it very, very well. Did it go beyond that? I don't know. I think they just they dismiss America. I mean, America's every single day we hear ZANU-PF MP or an official speaks, they talk about the illegal invasion of Iraq. And so they beat Zimbabwe up, they beat Zimbabweans up over American, the rest of America's foreign policy. They say, we don't invade people. We don't do what George Bush does. How many millions have died as a result of America's foreign policy? They use that against the democratic forces. So America's foreign policy in Zimbabwe has no effect whatsoever. It will only, if there is a solution, it will only come through Africa. Although Mugabe would like it to be a bilateral issue between Britain and Zimbabwe. That's what he wants. He wants to beat up the colonial powers, and he wants to go shopping in Harrods. Yes, hi.
While we're talking about money, I wanted you could talk a little bit about aid for the drones in Zimbabwe today, probably. In particular, the humanitarian aid. Because there was a piece in the Economist article on the road about how the government takes a big chunk of it, about the journey.
Okay.
You could verify it and then say what should be done about humanitarian aid.
A lot of normal aid that would go into a developing country has been cut off as each country got more and more disgusted with Zimbabwe. Lots of project aid got cut off. The humanitarian aid has actually been increased. When it comes to food aid, through the Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome, the food is bought, so no money is crossing the borders. If you, let's take the other aid projects. There is a black market and a formal market. So when ITV went for dinner in Harare about 6 weeks ago, if they had paid for their dinner at the official rate of exchange, it would have cost £125,000 for dinner for 11 people, $250,000. So it's an insane exchange rate. But what they do, it's some embassies, the Norwegians are changing their money at the official rate. Okay? I think the British have negotiated and the Americans have negotiated, but the Global Fund for HIV/AIDS, they cannot support Zimbabwe the way they would support other countries because of the exchange rate. This is 1.1 million to 1. The official rate at the moment is 30,000 to 1. Just do the differential. It just doesn't work. So the Global Fund will not do the money in Zimbabwe because of the exchange rate, because it's mad. So there has been a cut in aid, but not in humanitarian aid. Zimbabweans will not be Ethiopians and die like flies because US aid and the European Union are going to feed them. They're starting. They're going to feed 4.5 million before the next harvest next April. It's the highest amount of humanitarian aid that's ever gone into Zimbabwe, but it's going into food. It's not going into education and boreholes and development and small and medium enterprises. It's not going into the things that are going to make the country grow. It's just survival aid. Does that answer your question? I don't think I know more than that, other than it's this problem with the exchange rate. And there is enough humanitarian aid. And I do think that the UN mission as such in Harare, I have no idea what it does. When we found out that the life expectancy for women was 34 years old, I and other journalists telephoned the World Health Organization in Harare every day more than once for 3 weeks to speak to the director. The UN director happened to be a Zambian. He wouldn't speak to us because clearly the government was incensed with that statistic. They wouldn't speak to us. The UN won't help us at all. The UN won't even give us information. They invite us to functions that they want covered. I don't know what the UN does in Harare. I know what the World Food Programme does. They do a good job. But for the rest, I have no idea whether it benefits Zimbabweans or it benefits UN staffers. I have no idea. But all those old traditional Swedish-funded projects, Danish-funded projects, for filmmakers, for this and that, that's actually gone. And withered. Not only being cut, but withered.
A different question. Humanitarian
aid, that's
passed through
the government. Not food. It's bought food. They're buying the food in there, usually from South Africa. South Africa's got a grain deficit this year, so they must be buying from Argentina. They're not getting that money. They're getting some of the aid projects. They're getting a proportion of that. What the aid projects do is, some of them, hope I'm not talking out of turn now, they'll change a small proportion of their money at the official rate, which the government gets hold of, and the rest they're changing like Mugabe does on the black market. Mugabe makes 100,000% profit on every US dollar he exchanges. I worked it out, but it got the noughts right. We've got a problem with noughts in Zimbabwe. Yeah, no, it's mostly in hard goods as opposed to money.
Are there any more questions?
Yeah.
You said Mugabe is giving 30,000, but
his mother lived till 93.
Okay, so he's got another 10 years.
Mm.
What happens then?
God knows. I just have absolutely no idea. I mean, hopefully the whole lot of ZANU-PF will shuffle off and count their money and let get on with the country. I mean, it's a very unstable, within ZANU-PF it's extremely unstable. Some of them are extremely unhappy. They want Mugabe to go, but they're never going to stand up for him in case they lose some of their advantages and money. I don't know.
Could you say a little bit, again, about daily life there? What do the children do? And in terms of crime, I'm not talking about the brutality of the regime, but people to survive, has this increased?
It's a lot safer than Johannesburg. I'm much safer in Harare than I am in Johannesburg. Or in Cape Town, much safer there. There's a traditionally low crime rate, and violent crime is very rare in Zimbabwe. I'm sure it will get worse. The daily, for the people in the townships and the high-density suburbs, they're with their buckets, they're walking first thing in the morning, the women are out there with their buckets to go and find water. There's open sewage passing their doorsteps. The children will go to school, even on the hot seating, children are going to school in neat little uniforms, beautifully behaved, going to schools without textbooks, with undertrained teachers because the best teachers have gone to South Africa. They're scrabbling for food all the time. It's how will we get a tomato and some protein and calories? How will we find enough calories for the day? And there's a constant planning, detailed planning for survival every day. I'm talking in the urban areas, okay? There hasn't been electricity in about 70% of Zimbabwe, it's 70% of Harare for 9 days. And it's going to get worse because they've just shut down the power station at Kariba for maintenance, I read this morning. It's going to get even worse. I mean, it's very hard doing without power. So people are foraging for wood. So there's this smoky haze across Harare, which has been a very clean city, very, very clean city. It's utterly miserable, but the children, they're going to school. They look wonderful. I am amazed they're still going to school. They're paying their school fees somehow. There's this network in South Africa that the UN and I discussed about 3 weeks ago. I was telling them what I had seen in Johannesburg. Every family has a member of the family that's gone to South Africa or gone to the UK. And they're sending food home in a complicated, efficient, effective food chain going across the border in the little pickup trucks. Much more efficient, much more cheaply done than the UN could ever do it. And it's feeding millions of people. And so every family has somebody doing it. What they're doing in Johannesburg, I suspect that the crime statistics in Johannesburg are not unrelated to the number of Zimbabweans in Johannesburg. But inside Zimbabwe, I'm much safer there. I'm sorry, it never fits into people's. Maybe it's because we're not telling the story right. And that's why things are difficult to get published, because it's not dramatic. Does that answer at all? What was the rest of the conversation?
Well, what you're saying is the kids are going to school.
They're going to school. They're not learning anything. They've got no books. The teachers aren't trained. They're no chalk for the... There are hardly any teachers because the teachers can't afford to get to school. The bus fares are too high for them. So they mill around at school, but they go to school. Some schools are better than others. They're probably better in the rural areas, although the pass marks at O levels, which is our O levels, is about 3% in the rural areas and always has been very low because the lower quality teachers go there, but the teachers there have got accommodation, they don't have to travel to school. The urban teachers, very often they go off on Thursdays and Mondays. They go to South Africa to buy goods to come back and sell. So very often Thursdays, Mondays and Fridays, there are almost no teachers there because they've gone to cross the border to go and get. So the children have a massively interrupted educational program. The University of Zimbabwe, which has produced wonderful scholars internationally, has not one single hall of residence open because they smell too much and the plumbing has broken down. So they've been closed by the health department, and so these university students who come in from the rural areas have nowhere to sleep. They're sleeping in the drains. There are whole sections of the university with chains around the doors to the department. Geology, survey, anatomy, you name it, they're closed. the law department's still open, and the law professors say they're producing the best lawyers in Africa still. There are a few very dedicated guys there. The political science department is open, but engineering department's not working. They haven't got any lecturers. They just haven't got any lecturers. I mean, the university stinks. The University of Zimbabwe stinks. Physically stinks. I can't bear to drive through it. And these pathetic students, you know, and definitely the standard of education of the students entering the university is so low now. It's gone. It's going to take 30, it's going to take generations to fix. I wish there was somebody.
Well, it's a public event, and so, you know, anyone's free.
Okay, I'm just curious. That would be interesting. In a second, what do you suggest people do if they care about the situation? You know, are there any really good individuals that deserve support?
Not the Anglicans.
That you can legally or bring you up, I mean, I think the greatest thing, you know, you're talking about.
You know, the Catholics, even if we have got an Archbishop of Bulawayo who was caught literally with his trousers round his ankles, he's an absolutely wonderful guy, Pius Mobert, and he is a great spiritual beacon in Zimbabwe. I heard this morning that the Bishop of Harare, Kunonga, has been replaced temporarily, I think, by a wonderful Bishop, Sebastian Bakare from Manicaland. I think that it is important for Americans to use what they can to persuade Africa. I know it sounds such a long shot, but any solution will come out of Africa. So the work has to be done on Africa. George Bush has no role in Zimbabwe, nor does Gordon Brown, except in Mugabe once. It has to be the work that is done in Africa. It has to be that we need our scholars to get in and study in America, but not necessarily the ZANU-PF children coming and studying in America, because they take the money from the fiscus to get their US dollars, and these poor parents in Zimbabwe can't afford to get their children to America, and their universities are useless. So there's a whole generation of children who would be traditionally, the poorer children would have been educated at the University of Zimbabwe. Now their education isn't worth anything. So somehow there has to be this balance that please don't just educate the rich kids from Zimbabwe. It must be the kids from the parents who would normally have sent their children to state universities which no longer operate. That is an incredibly important thing. Engineers, technicians, have to be educated. The moment you can go into the UK in London, a building site in London, a friend of mine turned up for work there the other day, and they were the majority workers on the building site in London, were Zimbabweans, the carpenters, the electricians, the plumbers. They're good. They work hard. They're cheerful. Honourable. So education is massively important. But politically, jobs. Mugabe to go. Hope that it's not too long so that people don't buy homes in Washington and stay here forever. Hope that they'll go home. That they're educated, that there's an educated group of Zimbabweans ready to go home when the time comes. I think there is. I mean, people I know who are studying here at the moment, Violet, who I spoke to this morning, I'm sure she'll go home. I hope she's Director General of the ZBC. I hope Violet will be that. I'm counting on her. That's what we can hope for, but it's too uncertain. And thank you for your concern over Zimbabwe, and thank you for the freedom of, thank you for your concern and your, the freedom of America, and thank you for feeding them. I want them to all live. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming. I I also want to recognize Victoria McComb. We have a new program at USIP called Media and Conflict, and that's one reason why we were so happy to have this opportunity to bring you here. This is the third project, third program this week. So it's been a busy week for Media and Conflict, but that's the program that she is heading up. So
thank you.